I have to use this mic, unfortunately, because of this web broadcast. So I feel like I'm talking out into an auditorium. But my name is Scott McLean. The topic that I'm talking on sort of follows on the theme. I don't know if all of you were here for the last hour or not. It follows on that theme in the sense that it deals with what happens if you try and do something about those corporate oppressors trying to shut you down. Let me tell you who I am, first of all, and how I got involved in talking about this. I'm a lawyer in Atlanta. I've done a lot of work with Electronic Frontier Foundation over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, and also worked with Electronic Frontiers Georgia in the lawsuit that group brought to strike down, I don't know if any of you remember it or not, the Georgia legislature passed a law a few years ago trying to make it illegal to communicate with pseudonyms or anonymously online. And Electronic Frontiers Georgia was one of the lead plaintiffs in challenging that statute. And after that case, I've had a sort of a never-ending stream of interesting calls from people who are getting screwed over in one way or another because of something that they do online. And one of the most common things is folks who are dealing with online websites, attack sites. Basically, they've been screwed in some way or another by a company. Typically, they're consumers that have been burned. Sometimes it's ex-employees that got a raw deal or for some other reason have a beef with a company. And you know, in the pre-internet days, that was the end of it. Basically, you got screwed and you went on with it. But obviously, with the web, it's easy. Anyone can put up a website and just basically trash the company. I'm going to be talking today about that, about the company website attack site phenomena. And but the primary thing that I want to talk about is if you are someone who's considering doing it, what you can get away with, where the risks are, where the lines are, and basically give you some idea of the ground rules for pulling something like this off. The this is actually kind of an old slide. This website, consumerama.org, I don't know if any of you have seen this website or not. What it is a complete catalog of corporate attack sites. And the last time I saw this site, there were over 200 in there. It's all organized alphabetically. They give prizes for the most interesting flames or whatever. Companies notice this, and they actually monitor the consumerama.org website to try and see if they've popped up on it. And Business Week has written an article saying that there are over 200 different companies now that have some sort of an anti-corporate website that deals with them. Consumerama.org? It should be Consumerama. It's probably misspelled on the slide. My favorite example of anti-corporate websites always deals with U-Haul. And the reason for this is that the only case that I've been directly involved with that has actually gone to a lawsuit is with U-Haul. I know of two, or actually, I guess, three lawsuits that have been filed strictly based on consumer website speech. One of them is Bally Fitness, which I'll talk about in a little bit. One of them is Terminix, which you may have heard of, went all the way to the eve of trial, and then Terminix gave up and went home. And then the third one is U-Haul. And the U-Haul case is near and dear to my heart because the consumers that are in the process of defending themselves against U-Haul are two kids who live in Athens, Georgia. They rented a truck in South Florida, rented a U-Haul truck in South Florida for a move up to Athens, and had all kinds of trouble with the truck along the move, and basically had a horrible, a nightmarish experience with U-Haul, which culminated in U-Haul seizing their truck in Jacksonville, claiming that they had overloaded it. They weighed the truck, and U-Haul said they had overloaded this truck by 10,000 pounds. And so U-Haul wouldn't release their possessions, just basically locked them up on the tow yard and said they were going to have to pay for all the damages to the truck. And then until they called the police, and eventually they were able to move all their stuff onto a rider truck and complete the move. But all along the way, the U-Haul is telling them that if they had any problems with it, they were going to have to take it up with customer service when the move was over. And, of course, they get to Athens, they call U-Haul customer service, and U-Haul customer service says, well, we can't do anything about it. You have to go back down to Jacksonville and deal with folks down in Jacksonville. And they had a catch-22 runaround with U-Haul for a while and eventually decided to take it to the web. And they published this first website, which is the U-Haul website. Whoops. Back up. I didn't mean to get to this slide yet, but this gives you some idea of what can happen when the company steps across the line. The U-Haul website, these websites are all over the board. The U-Haul website, let me see if I can back up one. Hold on just a sec. There we go. Okay. These websites take all kinds of different forms. The U-Haul website it's amazing that people have this much time to dedicate to a grievance. You can tell how pissed off they were. What they do, the guy who's actually the author of this site, the guy's by the name of Coyote Osborne, who lives in Athens, and he has written in just excruciating detail the story of his nightmare with U-Haul. And it's a really good story. I mean, the guy's a very creative author anyway. And so the story is just in vivid detail. But in addition to providing this vivid detail, he set up a call-in line, you know, where you could send an email directly to U-Haul's customer service and tell them what you thought about this after you'd read through the whole thing. And U-Haul was getting hundreds of emails from this customer service site. And he set up a place where other people could post their U-Haul stories. And you know, it was just this huge consortium of people who were trashing U-Haul on this website. And it got U-Haul's attention. And they filed a lawsuit against him. Remember, he lives in Athens, Georgia. They filed a lawsuit against him where U-Haul's headquarters is in Phoenix. And it was, you know, 30-page long federal lawsuit alleging trademark infringement and trademark dilution, all kinds of stuff. I'm going to talk about some of the things that companies can, some of the tools they can use in a little bit. But U-Haul just essentially opened fire on this guy 2,000 miles away from home. And this move, I mean, the guy had never been, they'd never even seen the Grand Canyon, never been to Arizona. He and his traveling companion were both unemployed at the time. They were trying to set up a small press fantasy sci-fi publishing business out of their bedroom in Athens. And so these guys were just at a loss as to what to do. And they ultimately got to me through the Electronic Frontier Foundation and EFGA, and we defended the lawsuit and got the case dismissed out in Arizona. I'll talk a little bit more about the jurisdictional issues is what was going on out in Arizona. The jurisdictional issues refers to the idea of personal jurisdiction is where you can be sued for doing something. Normally you can't be sued in Alaska for doing something in Georgia, but there are some exceptions that I'll talk about. We got this lawsuit dismissed out there in Arizona. And you have to understand, I wasn't charging these guys for my time, but U-Haul's lawyers weren't doing it for free. U-Haul had to have invested $100,000 in the lawsuit in Arizona before getting thrown out of court. 6 months later, after sending a series of death threats basically to these guys after the Arizona lawsuit was dismissed, U-Haul filed another federal lawsuit, this time in Athens, Georgia, which they could do because the reason the Arizona lawsuit was thrown out was because the court decided that wasn't the right place to bring this lawsuit, but it didn't end the case. It just said you can't sue them in Arizona. So they filed a new lawsuit in Arizona. That was a year and a half ago now. We have been litigating the case for a year and a half, and right now we're scheduled to go to trial in October on counterclaims primarily. After U-Haul finally filed this lawsuit out in Arizona, we answered and we filed counterclaims against these guys for false imprisonment because they were locking all stuff up down there in Jacksonville and unfair business practices and all everything I could think of, basically. And that case now is still pending. It's scheduled to go to trial in October, and you know, from there there's appeal and so on. I mean, so it can be a very serious issue. They are vicious people. They really are. U-Haul is a vicious, vicious company. Side commercial, don't rent trucks from U-Haul. They are a nasty group. Well, you know, the odd thing about it is, and by the way, I want this to be totally open and informal. So feel free to chime in at any point if you've got comments or you want to ask questions along the way.
Quick announcements on the comments and questions. Please address them to the microphone so we can record them for the website, so our web listeners will be able to.
Okay. The comment was that your dad had a problem with U-Haul, and that they were a nasty and relentless company, and that's certainly been my experience with these guys. They are nasty, and as you can see, that is something that has not gone unnoticed on the web. And this is the cool thing about the web, of course, for doing this kind of thing, creating anti-corporate websites, is you just have so much flexibility for what you can do. And you can, it's one thing to write a grousing letter like your grandma does to the newspaper complaining about something that a company does, but it has absolutely nothing compared to the impact that you can create with a website. And some of these things, I can't believe that U-Haul suing my people with this website out there. This is one of my favorites. May save you money if they don't kill you. Now, I've only got the front page on all of these because I didn't want to be online here, and so I've just saved the front page. But you can see this woman's got all of her images of this truck. And as you go deeper and deeper into the website, this is pictures of 2020 did an episode on U-Haul. I don't know if any of you saw this. There was various scenes, dead babies and all kinds of stuff. And this woman took snapshots from the 2020 episode, captured apparently had a video captures, and she's got pictures of all these horrible wrecks and so on. And then you saw the graphic of the little exploding U-Haul truck. This is a good example of the sort of pile-on that can happen once one of these online discussion groups gets going. This guy's got a fairly detailed website, which is pretty tame. It's mostly text as you go through the website. But one of the parts of his website is a complaint list where he lets basically anyone post. And this complaint list goes on for 60 printed pages. It goes on and on and on and on. And, some of it is just general trash sites, but a lot of it is really detailed descriptions of stories. And when you get on a search engine and you search for U-Haul, most of the search engines are set up now where they'll bring up the company website first. But they'll also, a lot of them have a specific section that says complaint sites. And, these companies, you can't turn on look at financial press without talking about how you have to be marketing on the web. Companies that are screwing up like this, when the consumer goes out there to try and find U-Haul on the internet, they're going to find U-Haul, but they're also going to find a long list of people that are complaining about them. So this is not an insignificant thing for companies, nor is it an insignificant thing for consumers. You really can have a voice if you've got a company that's treating you badly. This is the website that I was... or the slide that I was about to get to, the point here is simply the power of pictures. You can't say anything that looks like Ronald McDonald with a bloody hatchet. PETA makes its point a lot more graphically and a lot more effectively, or the U-Haul exploding truck, or this Anal Mart thing. This is one of my favorite anti-consumer websites. It's WalmartSucks.com site. And this guy, it's not clear to me whether he's just an unhappy customer or a disgruntled former employee, sort of dodges it. But it's another one of those sites that's huge. I mean, it is the central place on the internet for trashing Walmart. And in addition to the images, people can get creative with sound. One of the big problems with U-Haul that is complained about on a lot of the websites is... Oh, okay. Are you ready? Okay. One of the common complaints with U-Haul on the websites and in any other consumer publications is the fact that they won't keep their reservations. I mean, if you call up and think you have a truck reserved for U-Haul, you don't. I promise you, you don't. All that means is they've told you to come by and pick one up, and if they have one there, it will be there. This website, are we all ready to go on this?
Oh, I'm sorry. We have no midsize available at the moment. I don't understand. I made a reservation. Do you have my reservation?
Well, yes, we do. Unfortunately, we ran out of cars.
But the reservation keeps the car here. That's why you have the reservation.
I know why we have reservations.
I don't think you do. If you did, I'd have a car. See, you know how to take the reservation. You just don't know how to hold the reservation. And that's really the most important part of the reservation, the holding. Anybody can just take them.
Companies hate this. And, whoops. Did I just play it again? There we go. Okay, so that's the rest of the time. What I want to talk about is what the consequences are and how you can do this sort of thing and do it as creatively and as vitriolically as you want to, while minimizing the chance of having the kind of experience that Coyote Osborne is having with U-Haul right now. Now, first of all, I should tell you right off the bat, and you probably all figured this out, it's not a free speech zone, really. I mean, the Supreme Court has now made it clear that online communication is entitled to the fullest First Amendment protection of any other kind of speech. It's a free public forum. It's just like standing on a soapbox out in the middle of the Village Green. Anything that you can do in any other context in terms of speech, you can do online. Full First Amendment protection is and that was not a foregone conclusion. The ACLU versus Reno was a very important case because there was a lot of bad precedent that dealt with alternative communications media, particularly in the cable TV industry and in broadcast TV, that applied a much lower standard of what was permissible. And you know, you can't say the naughty, dirty words and so on in broadcast TV and so on. And there was a big push in Congress in the mid-90s to try and graft that standard onto communications over the Internet that would have essentially reduced the level of discourse in online communications to what would be appropriate for an elementary school, in effect. That debate is passed now. I mean, it is a full and open forum. But that doesn't change the fact that the rules that restrict what you can say in normal discourse also apply online, and a lot of those things can get you sued. The first and in many ways the most important thing to keep in mind is a sort of a sobering reality about online communications is that it's sort of the mirror image of the power that internet broadcasting gives you is the scope and the extent to which you can be sued a long way away from home. That's what I was referring to earlier when I talked about personal jurisdiction. What personal jurisdiction is the power of a court to reach out and grab you. And that power can be very considerable. Here's an example of that that's disturbing. I've already talked about the U-Haul example in a civil case, but here's a more scary example in a criminal case. You're all familiar with the idea of pornography being governed by community standards. What's legal in one community as racy literature or photographs or whatever can be pornography in another because pornography is defined by community standards. Well, what does that mean in the Internet? There was a couple who had a pornographic website out in California. It was actually just basically a download site. In fact, this may have even been in the pre-web days. It may have been a bulletin board. A prosecutor in Tennessee didn't approve and brought a prosecution against these California folks after a sting operation, in effect, where the police in Tennessee, the enforcement officers in Tennessee, downloaded pornographic pictures into Tennessee from this California website and then were shocked at what they downloaded, and so they brought the prosecution. The defense raised these jurisdictional issues and essentially said, you can't prosecute us in Tennessee for what we were doing in California because this stuff doesn't violate the community standards of the community where we were posting them. And the fact that you downloaded them into Tennessee is your problem, not ours. That it's not surprising that a prosecutor in Tennessee would bring this prosecution. What is surprising is that that decision was the prosecution's decision to prosecute in Tennessee prevailed at the district court level. The trial said, yep, you can be prosecuted here. And it went up to the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, which is a good chunk of the eastern United States. And the Sixth Circuit also affirmed that and said, yes, you can be subject to jurisdiction here for prosecution for according to the community standards in Tennessee. In effect, a lowest common denominator kind of thing. And there was an appeal from that to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari, which doesn't mean they approve of the decision, but what it means is that they did not reverse it and let that decision stand, and those folks were, in fact, prosecuted in Tennessee and are in jail. I don't know if they're out yet or not, but they actually went to jail in Tennessee. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Where did the extradition come on this?
Well, in California, but the question was not litigated in California. I mean, they didn't raise the jurisdictional issue in California. I don't know if there was actually an extradition hearing or not. Presumably, there must have been.
There should have been.
Presumably, there must have been. But the question of community standards was litigated through the Sixth Circuit in Tennessee, not in the Ninth Circuit, which would be California. It's a good point.
They would have had to have been removed from the state of California, physically removed from the state of California, and jailed in the state of Tennessee.
That's correct.
Now, there has to be an extradition proceeding for that. If they voluntarily went to the state of Tennessee.
That is a good point. And in the criminal context, you could raise these issues in the extradition proceeding. In a civil context, it's a little more complicated because in a civil context, let's take this U-Haul example, for example. Here, you've got a dispute. It's a move that happened in Florida and Georgia. You've got the guys who are getting sued live in Athens, Georgia. They've never been to Arizona. They got no contacts with Arizona. The only thing that they've done that has any effect on Arizona is that they put up a website that trashes a company that happens to have its headquarters in Arizona, even though they're talking about something that company did in Florida and in Georgia. U-Haul can file the lawsuit anywhere they want to. U-Haul filed its lawsuit in Phoenix. Now, when you are in that situation where you're the recipient of a lawsuit that's been filed all the way across the country, unlike the criminal proceeding where they've got to extradite you before they can bring you to justice, in the civil case, you're put to a Hobson's choice right away. I mean, you either have to answer the case out in Arizona, in which case you can raise the issue, you can raise the jurisdictional issue and try and get the lawsuit dismissed, or you can just ignore the lawsuit out there in Arizona. But if you ignore the lawsuit, then they will take a default judgment against you. And the only issue you've got left, then they still have to come now to Georgia to enforce their judgment against you. But you've lost the right to challenge any of the underlying claims now. The only thing that you can do when they come to Georgia is say, you didn't have any jurisdiction over me in Arizona. You couldn't sue me out there. Therefore, this judgment is invalid. If you win on that, you're okay. But if the court decides, now you were subject to jurisdiction out in Arizona, then you are completely screwed, and you lose the chance to raise your First Amendment defenses, to say your claim was meritless or anything else. You had a question? Okay.
How does this work on an international level? Someone's threatened to sue me in Amsterdam. This happened with the eToy situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it also has happened with Amway. Amway is a company that's got a bunch of there's a lot of people out there. It's kind of like the Scientologists, same as the Amway, or kind of like the Scientologists. A bunch of anti-Amway websites out there, and Amway just goes nuts trying to shut these things down. And a lot of that has every time they've successfully shut one down in this country, those sites have been mirrored, in Australia and Japan and so on. The jurisdictional issue internationally is a totally open question. There is no guidelines yet on that. You're a lot safer, frankly, I'll tell you this, you're a lot safer ignoring the subpoena that you got to go show up in Zambia to defend yourself than you are ignoring the subpoena to go defend yourself in Arizona, because the chance that a court in Georgia is going to think that court from Zambia had jurisdiction over you is very, very small. But there are no clear rules yet. That is definitely an open question.
What about if you're a a U.S. citizen, and this thing happens when you're overseas. I've traveled for work occasionally, several months at a time, abroad, other countries. I'm a citizen, have a passport and everything like that. Supposing I'm in Belgium or Norway or Australia or something like that, and while I'm gone, you know, I get this, you know, my mail piles up or something like that. I don't answer it. Do they have to come and get me in the outback, or, you know, is it on them to do that, or is this something that's waiting for me when I get back?
If you're here,
can I say? Well, I'm sorry. I've been, you know, three continents in the past 9 months. That's my stack of mail. You are number, you came in as number 542 of 800 pieces.
Well, there's, there are two answers to that. The first answer to it is that courts have a distinct lack of sense of humor about the failure to respond to a subpoena. That's the bad news. The good news is that you can't be sued unless you are actually served with the lawsuit. It ain't a lawsuit until they actually serve it. Just, I mean, someone's got to put the process in your hands. Now, there are ways to serve someone short of actually putting the process in their hands, but there are a lot of safeguards that are built into the system to make sure that you actually get notice of the lawsuit. They have to either put it in your hands, or they have to leave it with someone who is an adult who lives in your current residence, things like that. I mean, so they can't just send you an email and say you've been sued in Arizona, and then you find out about 6 months later. They have to actually serve you with process.
What about service by publication?
There are very, very rare circumstances in which service by publication works, not in something like this. Typically that works for, like, if it's a lawsuit over property
or divorce.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, there are very specific ways that you can serve people by process. And if someone's going to sue you for something that you're doing on the net, actually there is one exception. If you're using someone's domain, if you've registered a domain name that is a company domain name, like, for example, I've got a guy who registered the domain name promina.com. Basically, Pramana treated his wife very, very badly, and he got upset, and they got into a lawsuit. And while the lawsuit was pending, Pramana's website, it's the hospital system, you know, Pramana's website was at pramana.org, and he registered the domain name pramana.com. And that happens. Sometimes people are doing that for the purposes of trying to sell the domain name back to these companies, but sometimes people do it because they want to put up their trash website at the company's domain name, so that when someone goes to find promina.com, you know, they end up seeing the trash website. Well, that creates some more difficult issues that I'll talk about as I work through this slideshow. But if the registrant of a domain name can't be identified, that is, the address that you gave NSI in your registration is invalid, it's out of date, or something like that, then the cyber squatter statute, which I'll talk about, gives someone who claims that domain name as their trademark the right to sue the domain name as opposed to suing you individually. And if you're suing the domain name and you can't find the registrant of the domain name, then you could do a service by publication. That's situations like that. But in general, the answer to your question is no, they got to put it in your hands if they're going to sue you. Okay, well, just to finish up quickly on this personal jurisdiction idea, there are some rules. It's not unlimited. As I said, in this U-Haul case, for example, we beat the personal jurisdiction claims out there. We actually filed a motion to dismiss the Arizona lawsuit on the grounds that there was no jurisdiction out there. And the rules are, they're very, personal jurisdiction is something that drives first-year law students nutty. It's very, very complex. But in a very quick nutshell, if you are doing something that is an attack on an individual where the damage is being suffered in a particular jurisdiction and you intend to cause damage to that individual in that jurisdiction, then the chances are pretty good that you can be subject to jurisdiction there. The case that establishes this is Calder versus Jones, and it's the Jones is Shirley Jones of Partridge Family fame. National Enquirer has published an article about her that said she had a drinking problem, and I don't remember what else. It was all kinds of nasty stuff about her. She sued National Enquirer out in California, even though National Enquirer was based in Florida, and said, you meant to hurt me. You published this in California. I suffered all the injury in California. I should be able to sue you here. And the court said that you can. And that model has been translated into the internet context. You probably heard of the Drudge Report. Matt Drudge, a political commentator, got a website that he basically publishes out of his house in California. But it's one of the most widely read political gossip sheets in Washington, D.C. And several years back, Drudge published an article claiming that Sidney Blumenthal, who was a Clinton aide, was a wife beater. And, you know, within about 6 hours of that thing hitting the internet, Blumenthal's lawyers had sent letters to Drudge saying, you know, retract it, it's a lie, we're going to sue you. And Drudge did retract it immediately, and they still sued him for $10 million in Washington, D.C., on the other side of the country. And he raised the jurisdictional issue, and the court applies the same Calder versus Jones idea that says, no, you meant to trash him. You trashed him in D.C. You knew he was going to suffer the injury in D.C., so you got to go to D.C. and defend yourself. Now, the flip side of that is, and what we're talking about here, I think this normally will work. This is the argument that we made against U-Haul and were successful, which is if you're dealing with a company, the injury isn't in a single place. I mean, if you're talking about a company that does business all over the country, the idea that they suffer their damage in the corporate headquarters, it doesn't translate. And therefore, they ought to have to come to sue you where you are, as opposed to forcing you to come and defend yourself in a foreign jurisdiction. There's also fairness issues that the court will look at. And if you're dealing with a big billion-dollar corporation versus an individual who didn't do anything in that jurisdiction and doesn't have the financial means to defend themselves in that jurisdiction, then the court relied on that argument as well in the U-Haul case, and that can work. But understand the practical problems of all of this. Now, I mean, these guys, Coyote Osborne had a lawyer that was representing him pro bono because I thought it was an interesting case. That's almost always not going to be the case. I mean, there's a finite amount of legal resources out there, and finding someone to represent you for a price that you can afford in a lawsuit 2,000 miles away from home is a considerable problem. So, I mean, keep everything that I tell you for the rest of this show. If you're thinking about putting up a company website, keep that in mind. I mean, there is a risk here, and most companies exercise better judgment than U-Haul and just ignore these things, but there's always that risk, and the ability to defend yourself can be tough. If you get sued, the primary thing that you have to be aware of when you're putting up these websites, the primary thing you can't do in speech, not just on the internet but in any context, is to defame someone. Defamation is essentially making a false statement about someone that damages their reputation. It's a lot more complicated than that, but in a nutshell, that's what it comes down to. If you say anything on the internet about a company, about an individual, whatever, make sure it's true. If it's false and it's a trash site, the case books are already full of lawsuits in online context for people. A lot of them are, you know, good old fashioned Usenet flame wars that have resulted in lawsuits for defamation. So make sure that what you're saying is true. If it's not true, then you have to try and cram it into one of these categories to avoid liability. One of them is expressions of opinion. Defamation doesn't apply to expressions of opinion. That is to say, it has to be a statement of fact. If you say that someone's a thief, that's a statement of fact that can get you sued. If you say that you think he's dishonest, that's an expression of an opinion, and you can't be sued for that. And, you know, of course, the opinions can be as vitriolic as you want to, as long as it's clear that you're qualifying it in a way that says that it's an opinion. There's also a lot of constitutional limitations on the defamation claim now, particularly when you're dealing with big companies and you're talking about their consumer practices. Under the Constitution, traditionally defamation was just what's called a strict liability tort. That is, if you said something that was false, it didn't matter whether you fervently believed it was true, you were still screwed. That was it. I mean, if it was false, you lost. That's not true anymore. if the person that you're talking about is a public official or a public figure, there the Constitution requires not only that it be false, but that you have doubts about its truthfulness. So that if you believe that what you're saying is true, then you are immune from a defamation tort if it's a public figure, like a big public company. Now, understand, that's something you've got to fight about. Yeah. Very tough. I mean, where it really comes up, the question is, how do you prove that? And where it really comes up is if you're republishing what someone else is saying. Like, for example, on the UHell website, where he's got the other people's horror stories section of the website, he's got like 30 different people who are putting up on his website stories about what UHell did to them. Well, I mean, as long as he doesn't have some reason to believe that those people are telling a lie, then this kind of constitutional protection is going to immunize him. Because the standard is very high. U-Haul's got to say, not only is this stuff false that this third person is saying about us, but you knew it was false. And there's no way that U-Haul can prove that. Now, if what you're doing is saying what happened to you, then this isn't going to give you as much help, because you're either telling the truth or you're not. And if you're telling the truth, then you know you're telling the truth. But if you're lying, you also know you're lying, and so that this standard doesn't help as much. There are also a lot of the next point up there, statutory privileges. There's a long, long line of privileges that can protect you. But again, all of these really require what the law calls good faith. That is, you have to believe that you have a right to be saying what you're saying. And these kinds of exceptions are things like, if you're commenting on something that you have a vested interest in, if you're commenting on a dispute that you're having, yeah, got a question. If you're commenting on a dispute, if you're commenting on an ongoing legal proceeding, things like that, you have what's called a privilege. And there's a question.
What about some of the laws that various states have come up with, not for defamation but for disparaging comments? The notable case here would be the Oprah incident. What impact does that have on the web, and has that case closed the door on that?
I'm not familiar with the Oprah situation that you're talking about. What's that? And that
Oprah Winfrey made a comment on her show about the what was it, mad cow disease, and
the beef industry
production,
okay.
And
yeah,
stuff like that.
I know what you're...
And the beef industry sued her.
Right. That case. That's a good segue into the next two slides. That case actually was dealing with a statute. Amazingly enough, there is a statute that was passed at the behest of a bunch of angry farmers many decades ago that makes it illegal to disparage agricultural products. And the beef industry was suing under that statute. That's obviously a very narrow situation that unless you plan to trash, you know, poultry products or something on the internet, you won't have to deal with that particular statute. But lots of states, Georgia has not expressly recognized this, but lots of states have, and Georgia may have, a general trade disparagement common law kind of claim that where you're trashing someone's products, you can be sued for that if it's again. But the same rules apply. It has to be false. It has to damage the reputation, and although it's somewhat unclear, I'm pretty confident that all of those constitutional kinds of protections will also apply. So the analysis is very similar.
I don't know when to toss this question in, but I had read online that Georgia has a law stating it is illegal to post a link to another website unless you have asked for their permission.
That is actually the same statute that I was talking about at the beginning. It's Georgia passed back in '93 a statute called the what was it called the Computer Privacy Protection Act, something like that. I can't remember what it was. There were two parts to it. The first part of it made it illegal to use any false name in any online communication, which of course also made it illegal to communicate anonymously or use screen names or whatever. And the second part of the statute made it illegal to use any trademark, trade name, image, something or other, without seeking permission first. And so the linking issue came up because people, of course, typically will use, if you're linking to a company's website or whatever, you use the name to say, I'm linking you to U-Haul's website. I'm linking you to Bell South's website or whatever. That was a use of the company's trademark that was literally prohibited by this statute unless you called up Bell South first and said, hey, and I'm putting up a website that trashes your company, and I'd like to put a link to your customer service so that everyone who reads my website can send you an email telling you how pissed off they are. And you know, of course, Bell South doesn't typically get that.
Has the law been upheld?
No. That was the statute that we brought the challenge to, and it was declared unconstitutional. So it doesn't exist anymore. Now, having said that, thanks. Electronic Frontier Foundation, or Electronic Frontiers Georgia, was the group that really, and Robert Costner, who is not here today because he's ill, apparently, but he was one of the founders of Electronic Frontiers Georgia, was one of the early attackers of that statute, and did a lot to raise public interest on it, and ultimately led to the lawsuit. So, you know. Yeah.
How long has that been since that?
The decision declaring it unconstitutional was in 1996.
Okay.
So, but there's still, you know, how things survive on the web. Yeah. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. There's, but it is, it's dead now. It doesn't exist anymore.
You mentioned if someone else posted something on your site and whether or not you believed it was true had an effect on it. How does the responsibility for the website fall? Because what if the company, say, goes after your service provider and tells them to take your page down? Or what if the company goes after the person who's posting on a website? Or if you just go and post it on a board somewhere and they go after you, do they have to go after you, or do they go after the board you published it on, or the company that's hosting the board? Who are they allowed to just go after anyone they want, or is there a specific chain they have to go through?
That's a great question. The answer to it is, oddly enough, the answer is driven to some extent by the Communications Decency Act, which that's the statute that I was talking about earlier. In case you're unfamiliar with this area, that's the statute where all the congressmen decided to make it illegal to say naughty words on the internet. The Communication Decency Act, though, also had, and that part, the you can't say naughty words on the internet stuff is what the Supreme Court struck down in ACLU versus Reno. But there was a different part of that statute which was not struck down, which still exists, which was designed to protect family-friendly online service providers like Prodigy or AOL who want to edit content, you know, and basically say you can't say naughty words on our service or whatever. I mean, any kind of regulation of content within the online service provider. The risk of doing that under the old common law rules was if you have editorial input into something that's being done, then you can be held liable as a publisher if you have editorial input into it. And so these guys like Prodigy, you know, arguably were having editorial input because they were saying, okay, if you're going to post on Prodigy, you can't post porn stuff or whatever. Therefore, if they let someone post something on Prodigy, the argument went, those guys are publishers of it and they can be sued directly. And in order to prevent that from happening in the CDA, Congress created immunity, total immunity for ISPs for anything that is published through their ISP, any online service provider. If the content is coming from someone else, the online service provider is totally immune and can't be sued for it. And arguably, I have made this argument. I haven't gotten a ruling on it yet, but I've made the argument that if you're putting up a website where you're letting other people publish on your website, that you're an ISP for the purposes of that website. You're providing online access, and therefore you're immune from whatever someone else says. And so if you have a complaint, if you think you've been defamed by someone who's saying something online, you've got to go to the author. You've got to go to the content provider. If that's the author of the website, fine. If it's someone who's providing information to the website, fine. But ultimately, you have to find the person who's the actual author. Now, that's the long-winded answer. As a practical matter, a lot of times these guys do go after the ISPs anyway on the theory that the ISP doesn't have a dog in the hunt and they don't want to get sued or spend money on lawyers to stand up for an individual user who's paying them $9.99 a month for, you know, access. But most ISPs are standing up. Like, I mean, Mindspring, for example, has a very strict policy. If they don't give any information out, they will not release information unless not only are they subpoenaed, but you actually get a court order compelling them to release the information. And a lot of the ISPs have similar policies. So the ISPs in general, I mean, most of the mainstream ISPs will stand by their users. As long as you're complying with their permissible use policies, the ISPs will stand by you. Mm-hmm.
And this is for slander, libel, defamation.
Yeah, well, again, a lot of times defamation is in the eye of the beholder.
Okay.
If a company actually files a lawsuit against you for defamation, they have alleged that you are defaming them, then they can get a subpoena from the, you know, they can go to the ISP. Actually, I've already passed on the slide, but the last point on this last slide was this ancient maxim of the law that equity will not enjoin a libel. What that means is if you are engaged in defamation, you can be sued for it and you can be held liable in damages. But what you can't have happen to you is a court can't order you to stop talking. It's a prior restraint on speech, and it creates traditional equity problems but also constitutional problems. Basically, you can say whatever you want to. Once you've said it, you might get sued for it, but a court can't enjoin you on the front end and silence your speech just because it's supposedly defamatory. So even in the case of defamation and where they've actually sued you, they still shouldn't be able to go to the ISP and shut you down.
Okay, this is going to be different in the case of copyright infringement claims, because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act created a safe harbor for the ISPs, but at a price that you have to turn your users in.
That's correct. Under copyright, it's also correct under trademark. There are other avenues of attack that companies can use that will allow for an injunction, typically intellectual property areas like copyright or trademark.
Okay. First thing is a clarification. You said that you do not have a ruling on extending the protection, you know, from ISPs to someone that puts up a website.
Right.
Are you expecting a ruling on that?
Well, I don't know if I'll get a ruling or not. The reason I had briefed this was, like I said, in the U-Haul website, they had done that. And in the original Arizona lawsuit, U-Haul had claimed defamation based on the things that these other people were saying as well. And so we alleged that defense in Arizona, and the court never reached it because they ended up throwing them out on jurisdictional grounds. When they refiled the lawsuit in Georgia, they dropped the defamation claims based on those other posts. So I don't expect a ruling in this case. And I think it's a really interesting issue, but I don't know.
Well, of course it's an issue. It depends on whether you as a, you know, putting up a web page to which you give access to other people to vent their feelings, are you a conduit and therefore protected, or are you considered a content provider even though you do not directly provide the content?
Exactly. I mean, I don't understand why AOL ought to have the protection if anyone who just puts up a website. I mean, as long as you're making online publication accessible, I think you fall within the statutory definition of an online service provider. But it's an open question. I mean, I wouldn't want to be the person who's defending the defendant in the lawsuit that tests that, because I can't predict how it will come out.
My next question was, we've discussed in the context of defamation, and I presume all the way up to libel, the truth and the knowledge. Where does malice come into this? As in Westmoreland versus, you know,
malice. Well, that's a constitutional malice question. There's actually two kinds of malice that come into defamation claims, and I didn't use the magic language, but that's what I was talking about earlier. Traditionally, on defamation claims, you have to prove that the defamation was malicious, and traditionally, what that means is that you had bad faith, that you intended to cause injury. Okay. But now malice also has a second constitutional meaning, and that is what I was talking about before, the actual belief that what you're saying is false. It's not enough to say something that's false. You actually have to have serious doubts as to whether or not what you're saying is truthful. That's what malice means in the context of a constitutional defamation claim. It's considered to be malicious if you know it's false. More questions on defamation?
I don't know. Not a question on defamation, but you said that they when they refiled the lawsuit in, when U-Haul refiled the lawsuit in Athens, they dropped the defamation. Is this a common tactic where, you know, they load up charges to try and frighten people and to try and get you to back off, and then when somebody actually stands up to them and they know they're going to be called on it and they know that it could create, like, you know, a test case or something like that, and they're probably going to lose, they'll just drop it so it doesn't even get brought up?
That's certainly what U-Haul, I mean, there's no question in my mind that U-Haul was shocked when we answered the case out in Arizona. I think that what they expected was that they were just going to scare the bejeebers out of these kids and they take the website down. And I think that that probably is what happens most of the time. In fact, U-Haul has sent death threat letters, you know, lawyer, we're going to sue you kind of letters to other authors of U-Haul. They've only filed one lawsuit, but they filed, their lawyers sent letters like this to other people, some of whom are no longer on the internet. Now, whether or not they took their website down because they got the letter or they just got bored and moved on or what, I don't know the answer to that. But it is a scary thing to try and stand up to a company in a situation like this. And the U-Haul basically had stepped in a large enough pile of dog poo that they now, some corporate counsel within U-Haul has his reputation on the line here. And so now it's a matter of corporate pride. But I'll tell you, they are offering us money to settle the case right now. I mean, we're the ones who are pushing it to trial, unless they pay all my attorney's fees, which they don't want to do. So they wish they'd never filed this lawsuit, and it would have been a lot cheaper for them not to have filed the lawsuit. I don't know what's going to happen at trial. Anything could happen at trial. I have a hard time imagining that a jury out in Athens is going to think that, you know, U-Haul's behavior is particularly inspiring as a corporate citizen, but another example of what you're talking about is the Terminix case. Is another situation where a company filed a all out full frontal assault website attack on a website. Some woman who had used Terminix as the termite treatment, and of course termites destroyed her house or something along those lines. And Terminix filed the lawsuit. She also had some lawyer up in Washington, D.C. representing her, kind of similar to the U-Haul situation. They filed a great brief, which I have plagiarized at length in my U-Haul case, responding to Terminix and got it up to the point of the court hearing on their motion to dismiss for fees and all that other sort of thing, and Terminix rolled over and dismissed the lawsuit. Not wanting to hear what the judge was going to say about it. So, again, this isn't an isolated incident, but it's still a very effective corporate tactic if you want to play hardball, because lawyers do this for a living. I mean, we can't give away our services for free all the time, however interesting the cases are, and it's, you know, so unless you find someone who just gets really interested in your case and thinks that you've been wronged and wants to do it, or you happen to have a trust fund, it can be a tough situation.
So basically, once they get a ruling on something, I mean, that makes case law, and so they could lose that tactic. It seems to be kind of a gamble, if it actually is ruled that that's not, right, or, that's not legal, then they completely lose that tactic. Yep. They can never use that again.
Well, it's interesting. Let me hold that thought. Let me skip through the next three slides real quickly, and then we'll talk about what you're talking about, because there is one reported decision where it actually went to a decision. It's the Bally Fitness case that I'll talk about in a sec. There's two other, let me talk quickly about two other torts other than defamation that sometimes come up that they're sort of obscure torts, but they actually do pop up in the online context. One of them is a tort called false light invasion of privacy. Short of defamation, if you depict someone in a false light, you can be sued for that. If the false light that you're depicting them in would be highly offensive to an ordinary person. And where this comes up most often in the internet is in a false attribution situation where you publish something that makes it look as if it's coming from someone else, and typically it's pretty offensive. And you see this more often in Usenet flame wars than anything else, but you could do it in the web as well. Lunny versus Prodigy is a case where on the Prodigy online service, a Boy Scout was someone who had a beef with this Boy Scout was sending emails and posting to Prodigy discussion groups in the name of this Eagle Scout, soliciting sex and you know, posting to littlegirlspictures.com kind of thing. And this lawsuit, he was actually suing Prodigy, and it was one of the early cases that established the precedent that the ISP could be liable for something like this. Ultimately, the Supreme Court said no, ISPs can't be liable for it. Jessup Morgan versus AOL is a similar situation. It was a divorce case where the husband's new wife was posting similar kinds of emails in the name of the old wife and saying, for a good time, call me at this woman's parents' house where she was staying. And this woman, the woman who was making these posts, the new wife, thought she had done it anonymously. And the case was a situation where AOL had been compelled to reveal her identity, and that turned out to be a messy thing for the divorce proceedings and so on, as you can imagine. But that is a... So the idea of false light is another danger area. Anytime you're posting something and making it appear that you're someone else in a way that is offensive to them, that creates potential liability. Yeah.
I had a quick question. Going back to the rulings on whether the one that you haven't been have a ruling on yet as to whether you could treat a person as a publisher, so they'd have the same immunity as the ISP. If someone's coming onto your site and they're putting comments onto your site and it's under anonymous names or under other names, where would that situation fall into it then? Would they fall back and be able to sue you as the publisher of the content
site? If the poster is doing it anonymously?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. The anonymity doesn't change the issue of the immunity. Like I said earlier, I can't guarantee you that you would be immune in that situation. But if the immunity applies to you, it applies whether or not they're anonymous. And typically in the CDA cases where the ISPs are fighting, I mean, you know, the ISPs are clearly immune. Almost always the situation is an anonymous poster, so that the guy who's getting damaged doesn't have any recourse against the actual person who's doing the defamation. The leading case on this is a case called Zaran versus AOL, and it related to the Oklahoma bombing of the Murrow building. Right after the Murrow building was bombed, someone on AOL started posting on AOL in the name of, I can't remember what Zaran's first name was, but anyway, Mr. Zaran. They were posting in his name all kinds of offensive things about the Oklahoma bombing, like, you know, pretending to sell T-shirts that made fun of the bombing and so on. And it got picked up. So, you know, this guy was getting all, and it has phone number. Edward Zaran was his name. Edward Zaran had his phone number. Please call me if you'd like a T-shirt kind of thing. And it got picked up by a disc jockey, a talk radio disc jockey in Oklahoma City, who was basically trying to encourage all of his callers to call up and make death threats. And Edward Zaran, literally, his phone rang constantly 24 hours a day with people threatening to kill him. And he couldn't identify who it was that had done these posts. I mean, he was trying to get AOL to take the post down, and it took AOL, you know, weeks to take the post down. When they finally did take him down, they said, sorry, it's not our fault, and we don't know who put the post up because we've lost that information. And so he was trying to sue AOL, and AOL raised this CDA immunity issue and said, well, you know, we didn't put the post up. We're not responsible for the content, so you can't sue us. And he won. I mean, AOL won, despite the fact that you had this egregious, you know, this guy's life was basically destroyed for 2 years. And the person who actually did the destroying was anonymous and did it with the assistance of AOL. They still said you're immune. So, you know, if this applies, you're home free.
Mm-hmm. Just on the tail of that, then they would then. I mean, if it were a serious enough case like that, they would be able to go to the person who had the site that the anonymous posting was done on. Potentially get a court order to get the log files to track the IP, and then go to that person's ISP and try to get their identity that way.
Right, that's the trail. Okay. What happens is they file. This comes up a lot on the Yahoo message boards where they have the securities. You know, you can go and you can comment on a particular stock or whatever, and it's all done anonymously a lot of the times. So you'll have people will file what's called a John Doe lawsuit. They don't know who the anonymous person is. You sue John Doe, and then you get a subpoena for the ISP as a third party. You go to the ISP and say, I'm suing John Doe, who's done whatever he's done. Either he's defaming me or he's engaged in securities violations on this website or whatever, revealing insider trading information and so on. Get the subpoena, go to the ISP. The ISPs, like I said before, they don't want to release this information. So if you get a subpoena, they might. Some of them will release it with a subpoena. Some of them, like Mindspring, will say that's not enough, and you actually have to get a court to order them to comply with the subpoena. Then they'll release their log files, and then you can identify the person that way. There's a lot of hoops to jump through, though. It's not easy.
Are there laws on how long the ISPs have to hold their log files?
No.
Do you know what the common length would be?
Don't wait too long. Yeah, and it varies a lot. I mean, if it's a little garage ISP, then those guys, or right, or like for example, like the anonymizers, or like EFGA has a anonymous remailer and so on. Those guys, once you start getting into the sort of the cyberpunk guys, they intentionally don't have the information at all, but they flush their stuff all the time so that they can identify them. So it just depends on who you're dealing with. AOL will have it around for a while. Mindspring will have it around for a while.
Back to the Terminex issue. Did they not continue that, though, and charge her with copyright violation?
If they have, I haven't heard about that. I know that they dismissed their lawsuit and her website is still up.
Yes, I understood they dismissed the lawsuit and then they were turning around and they were in the first stages of pursuing the issue in terms of copyright violation.
I hadn't heard
trademark
that.
Trademark infringement.
Interesting. Well, no, the trademark infringement claims were in the lawsuit that was dismissed, but they may have pursued copyright
violation
later.
Was specifically mentioned in what I read.
That's possible.
Well,
it depends. I don't know what the copyright claim would be, what they're alleging that she did. It's hard to say.
Is there a way to legally notify? I mean, you may have already answered part of my question, but is there a way to legally make an ISP act responsibly if someone does post as you? Because I have had somebody post as me before.
It violates virtually every major ISP's appropriate use policies to do that, and most of the ISPs are pretty serious about their appropriate use policies.
I mean, if you sent them a letter saying, I want you to take this message down, would there be any negligence on their behalf if you pursued a certified mail type route, a legal something where you could say that?
That's really what the CDA is designed to protect them from.
Okay.
You know, most of the ISPs are serious about appropriate use, and they will address the situation. But if they don't, it's almost impossible under the CDA to tag an ISP for something that for content that's being provided. The idea, the analogy is like the phone company. You know, I mean, if someone defames you over the phone, you can't sue the phone company. All they did was carry the information over the phone lines. And the ISPs we're trying to play that same model and say, look, all we are is a conduit for information. We're not publishing this information. We're just letting other people publish it.
I was just wondering if it might be different if, in fact, they had been notified in a legal means.
That was what the CDA was designed to deal with, because that was how you would set people up. Is, you know, you send them the letter first on saying this is infringing my trademark or this is infringing my copyright or whatever. Take it down, and if you don't take it down, I'm going to hold you responsible. And if they don't take it down, then you, at that point you can say that it was intentionally aiding and abetting the violation of the copyright and go after the deep pocket ISP, which, of course, all the lawyers would rather go after the ISP than some guy who's working out of his some 16-year-old kid who's working out of his bedroom in Seattle. You know, I mean, that's not a very interesting target. Mindspring's got a lot of money. They can satisfy a judgment.
But the John Doe suit, that route, and you can still get a settlement on your behalf with them basically not showing up, or...
Yeah, well, it depends on. I mean, yeah, it's a sort of a step-by-step process. Once you identify who it is, then you kind of have to reassess what you're going to do next. A lot of times, if it is a 16-year-old kid working out of his bedroom in Seattle, and you send a letter saying, "We know who you are. This is defamation. If it happens again, you're going to get sued." A lot of times it stops. You know, I mean, then people all of a sudden they realize that the internet is not nearly as anonymous as they thought it was, and you know, what people are willing to say when they think they're anonymous is a lot of times very different from what they're willing to say when they actually have to sign their name to it. So, you know, or maybe they, you know, at that point, maybe the guy says, it's not defamation, it's true, screw you, and I'm going to keep saying it, and then you have to make your judgment as to how you go from there, you know. Second, the next sort of alternative tort besides defamation is, this one doesn't exist in most states, but it is recognized in Georgia and some states, and it is called, it's an invasion of privacy tort called public disclosure of private facts. And the reason that this one's interesting is because it's unlike all of the other torts that we've been talking about, defamation, disparagement, false light, depiction, and so on. By definition, in this case, the facts that you're publishing are true. They're truthful facts, but they are secret and private, and their disclosure is highly embarrassing to the person who the facts are being disclosed about. And surprisingly enough, that also gives rise to liability in Georgia. I mean, you can be sued for this private disclosure of facts. The classic case of this is like you publish the nudie pictures of your ex-wife, you know, long after the happy days are past. You sell those to Hustler magazine or something like that. That's is a classic invasion of privacy tort. Yeah.
Does that apply to public figures?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, the answer is yes, it does apply to public figures, but there are very important constitutional restrictions on the public disclosure rules. And if it is a matter of public concern, or you're commenting on a public issue, and the information that you're getting is coming from the public record in some way, then you're immune. And generally speaking, it's almost impossible to tag someone for saying anything they want to say about a public official.
I was thinking specifically of the recent divorce of a well-known politician.
Yes. Well, there's a great that plays into that theme perfectly. There's a website. I don't know if you remember when Attorney General Bowers got in all of his problems with, the Georgia Attorney General, Mike Bowers, had a mistress, and they'd been rumored that he'd had this mistress for years and years and years, and he was a very conservative, strident attorney general. He was the one who had hired a young lesbian lawyer to come to work. He didn't know she was a lesbian. Come to work for the attorney general's office, Georgia Attorney General's office, and right before she graduated from law school at Emory, right before she started, she and her partner had a public lesbian marriage ceremony, and that landed on the front page of the local news, the law newspaper, and Mike Bowers then revoked her offer of employment. I mean, he was a big anti-gay guy. He's the Bowers of Bowers versus Hardwick, which is the Supreme Court decision that affirmed the Georgia anti-sodomy statute. So this guy's made a public career of being a moral hellraiser, and then he has this affair. And there was a website that was that revealed the identity, which was a big secret, revealed the identity of this woman that he was having the affair with. And the guy, who I've been on a couple of panels with him, he's a kind of a hoot, but he got lots of letters from Michael Bowers' lawyers alleging this kind of thing. But I don't think they would have actually been able to tag him for anything. He since... after that, published a website that just has a list of politicians of both parties who are supposed to be engaged in various sorts of extramarital dalliances, and that's still up. I don't know if the website's still up, but it's got little dancing naked women next to each person's name. It's a pretty funny website.
I say Larry Flynt's been making a career of that lately.
Yes, that's right. that's right. Well, I think that it's, I mean, it's supposed, I don't know if he's been sued for this or not. I apparently not, but it's certainly it's certainly funny if it's not true. It's a common law rule. It actually was originally recognized in Georgia in like 1915. It's been around for a long time. There's no statute. It's just something that was adopted by the courts over time. And I think it was originally recognized in Georgia in 1915.
And I'd been led to believe that in the U.S. the truth was an absolute defense against libel and such. So this really bothers me.
It is a defense against libel. That's correct. It's not a defense against this tort.
Okay, now, isn't it a bit, you know, aren't we stretching things to apply this tort to a, you know, company which by, you know, definition has a public presence because it's engaged in business?
Not necessarily. And let me. That's a good segue into this next example. This website, and I wish to heck I had copied this. I always copy these now. Any website I'm going to use, I copy them because things keep disappearing on me. But Bill Sheehan published a website. Bill Sheehan lives up in Seattle, Washington, and I think in Seattle, in Washington somewhere anyway. And this is a guy who has had a lot of problems over the years with credit reporting agencies. And he's got a serious beef with various credit reporting agencies. And he had a website which was notorious called the Liars, Scumbags, and Cheats website. And it was basically a website for him to trash everyone who had been involved in his credit problems over the years, the big credit reporting agencies, a couple of law firms, and so on. But what he did with it is, and the reason I learned about it is they tried to get an injunction. There was a lawsuit against him to try and get an injunction to shut his website down, which failed on the prior restraint issue that I was talking about earlier. The ACLU out in Washington represented him and got the case. They denied an injunction to shut the website down because it was an attempt to restrain his speech on the front end. But what this website did is, I think it falls within, arguably, this public disclosure of private facts tort with respect to a corporation, because he put up on his website it was kind of like the Nuremberg files of the credit reporting agencies. So you pictures of all the people that you know, all the creditors who were dunning him. He put their photos up. He somehow got a hold of all their social security numbers and driver's license numbers, and that was all up there. And he had pictures of their houses and their cars and their license plates on their cars and little targets on their heads. And it was a huge website. And another thing that he would do on this website was, this is why I wish I had copied all this stuff now so I could show you instead of describe it, but he would show up and take candid photos of people in the morning when they were coming out to get the newspaper, you know, in their bathrobe or whatever, and put that up on the internet. And that's the kind of thing. I mean, you can imagine the social security and driver's license number probably gets closest to the point where you're saying that's something that this tort maybe ought to apply to. But you can imagine that going even further. And the Nuremberg Files website that I was talking about is one where you had someone doing the same thing, but with doctors who were willing to perform abortions. And again, you know, it had the 10 most wanted list. And when one doctor was shot, then that doctor's name got crossed off the list with a check mark next to it, you know, that kind of thing. So it is possible to cross the line, and you have to be somewhat circumspect. I think it's a great exposing the darkness of what's going on inside a corporation ought to be protected. And if it's something that's arguably a matter of public interest, it is protected constitutionally. But that doesn't mean you won't get sued for it. And this is the tort that might provide someone a tool to do that.
I have a question. Uh-huh. I don't know when to time this. It's about parody and trademark.
Ah, good segue. Let's talk about that. Go ahead.
Okay. My friends are more into parody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not where they're saying this statement is true, but where it's blatantly obvious that it's not.
Right.
This guy Soylent runs Rotten.com, which is a pretty notorious site. He gets about as much traffic as the New York Times does, according to the rating places. And he's got other content. But he put up a comic that a friend of his did called The Dilbert Hole. This is patently very, very offensive. And the artwork is directly from the Dilbert trademark comic strip. And all he does is change the words. And just to give you a sense, like the first frame, the boss is saying, "Who wants to give me head in the toilet?" And then Dilbert and all of his colleagues are raising their hands, "I do, I do." And the last frame, the boss is being serviced, and he says, "You'll find my balls need extra attention today." Mm. Okay, it's really bad. I've heard of it. I want you to show me later. What surprised me about this, well, when Soylent gets letters from the lawyers, he immediately takes down the content because he's not into litigating, and he replaces with the
the letter from the lawyer instead, and so you can go read all these wonderful letters.
Yeah.
The ones that the United Artists sent him about the Dilbert hole were concerning trademark,
yeah,
which really surprises me because it's a parody of Dilbert, and so he's referring to it by their trademark name, Dilbert. Why did they choose trademark as opposed to other avenues to pursue?
Well, the only other avenue really would be a copyright argument.
That's what I expected.
But the problem with the copyright argument is you have a fairly extensive protection under copyright law in the guise of fair use. This arguably is a derivative use, but it's such a parody that it's creating its own work. And that creates a lot of complicated issues in copyright. Assuming that this is trademarked, it's kind of hard for me to visualize.
The word Dilbert is what they complained about.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of what I've got in my last couple of slides here is relating to issues right on this topic. There are a couple of. Let me talk quickly about the cyber status, and the next slide talks about exactly what we're talking about here. We're into the world of trademark law now in the Lanham Act, and there's a couple of different ways that companies can try and attack a website that they don't like in the Lanham Act. One of them is what's called the Anti-Cyber Squatter Consumer Protection Act, which applies only if you use their domain name or something very similar to their domain name. Basically, this is the statute that was passed to try and prevent people from going and registering a bunch of domain names that are someone else's trademarks because you figured out that Delta.com was going to be a useful domain name before Delta Airlines did, or McDonald's.com or IBM.com or whatever. There was a lot of people who did that and made a lot of money trying to sell these back to the companies that were late to the punch. But there are some decisions out there where companies use this statute, this domain name statute, as a way of getting at a company website if you register the domain, like the Promina.com website that I was talking about before. And the way this all plays out is it depends entirely upon the facts, because in order to win under this statute, a company's got to prove that you have a bad faith intent to profit from a domain name that has their trademark in it. That's ultimately what it all comes down to. And so if you register someone's domain name and you don't have a bad faith intent to profit from it, you just want to trash the company, technically this statute doesn't apply to you and you ought to win. But companies are really sneaky about the ways they try and set this thing up. The first letter that you'll get from the company will be a letter saying, well, we see that you've registered our domain name. We think that you're violating our rights, but we don't want to litigate this. So how about if we just pay you $1,000 for the domain name? And as soon as you say yes, then now they've proven, see, he really did have a bad faith intent to profit from it. What he was really trying to do was extort money out of us. So then instead of paying you the $1,000, they sue you under the cyber squatter statute. The facts of the cases that are out there, they give you some idea of where you get in trouble and where you don't. JoeCartoon.com. You guys may be familiar with Joe Cartoon. This guy does Shockwave and Flash, whatever it is, moving picture cartoons on the net, most of which involve animals exploding or being ground up in blenders and so on. There was a guy registered the domain name JoeCartoon.com, and he was a classic cyber pirate type. I mean, he had lots of different domain names that he had registered and was selling back to companies. But in this case, in JoeCartoon.com, he didn't actually offer to sell the JoeCartoon.com domain name back to the Joe Cartoon, the author of Joe Cartoon. What he did was he set up a web page that was basically an ad trap, so that if you went to JoeCartoon.com, a website comes up in your browser and ads are popping up all over the place, and you couldn't get out of the website without closing or clicking on like 15 different ads, which he was, getting 10 cents a pop for. And so his bad faith intent to profit essentially was that he set this trap for people trying to guess where JoeCartoon.com was, getting into this website and having to click through 15 ads to get out. In that case, the court said he loses under the cyber squatter statute because there's a bad faith intent to profit and JoeCartoon.com is their domain name. Now, contrast that with loosensucks.com. A guy registers the domain name loosensucks.com. It's using it as a source for trashing Lucent. And Lucent sues him, saying, "This is our, you're using our trademark in this domain name under the Cyber Squatter statute." In this case, Lucent loses. And the reason Lucent loses, as the court says, number one, no one is going to look at lucentsucks.com and think that that's Lucent's domain name, because Lucent isn't going to use lucentsucks.com as its domain name. The domain name itself is a parody on Lucent, and therefore you've got a First Amendment right to do that. But in any case, Lucent sucks isn't a trademark of Lucent. So that's the balance. If you are registering a domain name that is the actual company domain name, then you better be very, very careful about not having any evidence that you have an intent to profit from using that domain name. But if it's a parody domain name, you're probably safe.
Supposing that Lucent actually, like in a, I've noticed this particularly among technology companies, that they will copyright just about any word that they can possibly, well, not copyright, but actually trademark or service mark, just any word they can possibly get away with. If they could copyright the word or trademark the word "the," they probably would. And I've noticed that these in ads or most publications that the company puts out, these are listed very prominently in very tiny print. You have like a half page of them. You know, SGI has like, you know, their little threefold thing you pick up at a trade show, the entire back page is all the trademarks that they mention, not only in the brochure, but all the other products that they have. So if they actually registered lucentsucks.com as a trademark, could they sue you then?
Well,
and if they could, do companies that register a trademark, do they have to publish those trademarks? Do they have to make them known to the public, or can they keep them, just file with the Patent Trademark Office and then keep it secret? And
yes. You can't just register anything as a trademark. You actually have to use it as a trademark or a service mark in order to get a federal registration on it. And what that means is that you actually have to use the word. Are we running out of time? Okay. Well, we got to have to wrap it up here. Let's move on. The short answer to your question is they actually have to use it to mark their goods and services. If they use it to mark their goods and services, then the answer is yes, they could, this would apply. Since I'm running out of time, let me talk quickly about what the issue that you were raising, which is this idea of dilution and infringement, the other claims under the trademark statutes. Now, that Cyber Squatter statute that I was just talking about only applies if you've used their domain name as their trademark in your domain name. But obviously, the vast majority of these anti-company websites don't do that. They're published at some other domain, and they, you know, it's just someone's website. And in that case, in order to go after it under the trademark laws, the companies have to get a lot more creative. And they focus basically on two things, trademark infringement and trademark dilution, both of which, in my opinion, are garbage claims, meritless claims. But you got to litigate it to get there. And to give you an illustration of where they come out, I just want to talk quickly about these two classes of cases. The Bally Sucks case is the one that I was referring to earlier. This is the only decision I know of that has actually gone to a conclusion where a court actually issued a ruling on the merits of the trademark infringement and dilution claims. Basically, what the company has to prove trademark infringement is that you're using their trademark in a way that creates a substantial likelihood of confusion, and that you're somehow using it to mark goods and services, using it in commerce. Okay. Is it a purported decision?
I believe so.
Really? Oh, well, I'll have to look for it. I haven't seen that one yet.
The Starbucks case, a comic used the Starbucks logo and severely altered it. It was clear parody. But I believe it was not considered trademark infringement, but I think he was told not to do it anymore or something like that.
Yeah, well, you get into a lot. There's a ton of issues in these trademark infringement and dilution cases. One of them is, and dilution is the other one, and this actually applies more to your Dilbert Hole cartoon. Trademark dilution is the situation where you're using someone's trademark in a way that tarnishes the trademark, which is a legal term of art. It damages the trademark by associating it with negative and jarring images, exactly, which is usually the point, right? But the It still has to be a commercial use, but the classic case of a trademark dilution was I think it was either Penthouse magazine or Hustler magazine, one of the porn magazines. That was it, Penthouse. Okay, that had done a series of ads of the Pillsbury Doughboy. the Pillsbury Doughboy engaged in all sorts of acts of sexual activity that are probably not legal in Georgia, and Pillsbury, as you might imagine, didn't have a very good sense of humor about this, and so Pillsbury sued Penthouse, I think it was, or Hustler, whoever it was that did this, and that was a classic case of trademark dilution. So you can see that this, your Dilbert Hole situation is right down in that same area. But the key is it has to be a commercial use. In this case, Penthouse was making money off of these magazines, and so it had a commercial activity. But just because you're tarnishing someone's trademark in and of itself, if it's not commercial use, you're okay. Now, having said that, if a court doesn't like what you're doing, it's amazing how far they can stretch to find commercial use. And that's why I want to compare these two. The Bally Fitness case is this guy was, it was a consumer website, kind of like the UHEL website, very vitriolic. He was harsh. He got screwed by Bally and didn't like those guys. But the court threw out all of the claims, all of the trademark infringement and all of the dilution claims, saying no one's going to be confused when they open up this website and they see ballysucks.com. They're not going to think that this is the Bally website. And you've got to write First Amendment issues about being able to engage in consumer speech and so on. Now, contrast that with JewsForJesus.com, PlannedParenthood.com, and TheBuffaloNews.com. These are all cases where someone put up a website, although in all of these situations they registered the domain name of the agency, of the group that they wanted to trash. And JewsForJesus.com, for example, the JewsForJesus.com domain name was registered by a guy who was Jewish and was opposed to the Jews for Jesus organization and wanted to convince people not to convert to Christianity. Or in PlannedParenthood.com, it was an anti-abortion activist that had registered PlannedParenthood.com. So when you typed in PlannedParenthood.com and got to that website, it was someone saying, "Don't kill your baby." And BuffaloNews.com is the same thing. It was a competitor of BuffaloNews.com that put up in Buffalo. The Buffalo News is the Buffalo newspaper. The competitor registered that domain name and then put up what he said was a parody site of the Buffalo News, but it was the competitor, and he had a link to his own website. And that was the same case in Jews for Jesus and in Planned Parenthood. Either they were selling goods and services directly on the website, or in the case of Planned Parenthood, just had a link to a different site that sold goods and services. And the courts, because they were offended by what was going on the website, they said, "Well, the internet is very commercial in nature, and you're linking to other sites that are selling goods and services, and that's enough to have commercial activity, and so on." So it can be stretched a long way. We got one more question. I think probably we're wrapping up now. So let's.
Are there any issues with where you have the same domain name but the trailer like .com or .edu? Like, I know that there's a porn site called whitehouse.com. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if the courts have said anything about that. Like, you could use the same name but the different, instead of putting .com, like .org.
For the purposes of these trademark claims, usually, like in Planned Parenthood, PlannedParenthood.org was the Planned Parenthood website, and the domain name that was registered was PlannedParenthood.com. The courts don't really care. If you're using someone else's trademark in the domain name, the courts have this idea that it's a sort of a simplistic idea of how people find things on the internet, and the first thing that people are likely to do is type in your trademark.com. And therefore, if someone uses your trademark.com as an identifier for their website, then they are playing on that trademark. And even though once they get to the website, they're immediately going to know that this is not what they were looking for, there is that initial interest confusion. It'd be kind of like, I mean, in a real commercial setting, it makes sense. Like, for example, say I have a Chevy dealership, and Chevys are very unpopular, but Fords are very popular. So I put a big sign up on the interstate right next to the exit that you need to take to get to my dealership and say, "Ford dealership, this exit, you know, exit now." And someone wants to buy a Ford, so they take that exit. They get off the highway, And there's no Ford dealership there, but they see the Chevy dealership and they say, well, okay, you know, I guess I'll look at Chevy's instead. It's called initial interest confusion, and that's what the courts look at with this domain name, is that if you were Chevy and you registered the domain name Ford.com, even though someone was looking for Ford, if they got to your website, they might read your website, and that the courts don't like that. So that's what's going on in these cases. Any other questions? I think we're about done, but any other questions before we wrap it up? Okay, thanks a lot. Oh.